reflect on that.
It's an honor and a surprise to be here. I had several bets outstanding that gravitational radiation would not be detected in my lifetime. I now see that that was a bet against my health and not against the observers. And I owe several people bottles of wine, but I've gotten old enough that I can't remember who it was anymore. But they'll tell me, I'm sure. So a lot of what you're going to see with LIGO and are seeing, maybe all you're going to see for a while, comes from the death of massive stars. And so it's a big subject and can't tell everything, but I'm going to give some perspectives on current ideas about how massive stars die and how black holes get made. And I'm going to partition the mass space into a kind of a non-standard way. There's the things that are happening and dying today for sure, and we don't know exactly how they blow up. That's probably the biggest uncertainty, and for the more massive end, we're not exactly sure how they get there, what the mass loss is along the way. It's a big uncertainty above 35 solar masses. But we know they make black holes and neutron stars, and we know that starting around 8 solar masses, maybe a bit less with rotation, you have carbon burning and beyond. And between 8 and 10.3 solar masses for some set of stellar physics, these burning stages, oxygen and carbon and oxygen and silicon burning, can be quite complicated. They can be flashes. They can eject the envelope in some cases. But in the end, it's pretty clear that they make a neutron star. I'll show you why in a second. And above 10.3, everything ignites in the middle and stably, and you produce an iron core in hydrostatic equilibrium, which collapses like in the textbooks. And so that's those stars. But above 75, and this may not be much of an issue today in our galaxy with solar metallicity, because these stars all evaporate down and look more like these stars when they die. But if you imagine a population, say, at metallicity 0.1, where stars of 75, 100, 110, 120 are dying, then you encroach on the parent stability. And as time allows, I want to talk about that some too, especially the pulsational parent stability, which has its onset at 75 solar masses without rotation, 60 solar masses with rotation. So it's not extremely high, not out of reach. Now, viewed from the middle of a star, massive stars are not all the same. And the discriminant, the most important thing that says whether it's going to be a black hole or a neutron star, is the density gradient outside of the iron core. So the iron core is very similar in stars of different masses, 9 to 25 solar masses. But the density falls off because more massive stars have greater entropy. They're less degenerate. This region out here is puffier and extends out further. And the Chandrasekhar mass is not very well defined for a 25 solar mass star due to large thermal corrections. And so this stuff's going to fall down on the core and make it very hard to blow up. And so these stars are saying to you, I want to be a black hole. And this is saying, I want to be a neutron star. And in a little more detail, from 9.6 to 13 solar masses, the density profiles look like this. And whatever you may have heard, these stars are easy to blow up. It's almost impossible not to blow them up. I mean, look, neutron stars in baryonic mass extend up to about here, and the density's, you know, 1,000 grams per cc or so. So neutrino winds, very weak, you can get weak explosions, but it's pretty easy to get explosions. That means it's easy to make neutron stars. And in fact, half of the things that blow up are below 12 solar masses in current thinking. So a very large fraction of the neutron stars are coming from things that look like this, that can be blown up with neutrinos without rotation, leave relatively slowly rotating pulsars. All of these may be controversial statements, but it's what I think after looking at it a long time. Now, you can quantify this shallowness or steepness of the density gradient around the iron core by something called the compactness parameter that Ott and O'Connor invented. There's variations on that. But the things I was just showing you have almost zero compactness. That is, they're like bare white dwarfs inside of a loosely bound envelope, and they're easy to blow up. So up to 12 solar masses, easy. And then the density gradient gets shallower and shallower, and things like this are going to be hard. And then there's another valley, and there's an interplay of carbon and oxygen burning shells that's sculpting this curve. And then there's a region that's easy again, and then it gets hard. And then if it's solar metallicity and you have a lot of mass loss, it gets easy again. If you don't have mass loss, it just keeps on going up. So very loosely, these are the things we think will make black holes, and these will make neutron stars, and these are kind of indeterminate, and everybody spends a lot of time worrying about them. and probably rotation becomes important somewhere along here, for sure. Gamma ray bursts exist. So I'm going to talk briefly just to illustrate some points, not because this is the end point, but a lot of people have been doing surveys of stellar evolution, different masses, for a long time. One has just been done by Hager and Muller. We did this with Thomas Janka, where we made the stars and he blew them up. And of course, he couldn't blow up 200 solar mass stars. He has a hard time blowing up one on a good day. So we parameterized it by a standard proto-neutron star inside of 1.1 solar masses. And the contraction rate of that proto-neutron star was a free parameter, which was adjusted to fit five models for supernova 1987A, where we knew the explosion energy, where we knew the nickel synthesis, knew the progenitor mass, and so on. And so we calibrated a standard bomb. All the neutrino physics was handled consistently in 1D outside of that 1.1 solar masses. So we put this standard bomb in a couple of hundred pre-supernova models and explored the consequences. And this is not exactly the compactness, but you can see it's highly correlated with it. The merit of doing things that way is, in the past, we've often taken pre-supernova stars and just blown them up and say, let the kinetic energy at infinity be 1.2 times 10 to the 51 ergs. We ran them all with that condition. So they were forced to blow up with highly variable energy in the center, but a constant kinetic energy at infinity. Now we're putting the standard bomb in the middle of the star, and so what happens is very much a consequence of the pre-supernova structure, not dialed in ab initio. And so some stars blow up and some don't blow up at all. And the ones with lines here are actually the ones that blew up. And where it doesn't have a line, it became a black hole. In a little more detail, much more detail, here from 10 to 120 solar masses for one of the standard bombs, and we had five standard engines, but they all gave comparable results. Here's what happened. Things that blew up left neutron stars. Things that didn't blow up left black holes. And here right away is a question that I hope gravitational radiation is going to help us with. If you make a black hole, does the helium core fall in, or does everything that's left when the star dies fall in? The hydrogen envelope is not typically rotating fast enough to make a disk around the black hole. There are ways of ejecting the hydrogen envelope. It's very loosely bound. Eliot's talked about things. Elizabeth Lovegrove's talked about things. But if you make the black hole, does it have this mass, which is the mass of the helium core? Or does it have the mass of the whole star when it died, which is its initial mass minus the mass loss? And those are going to give you different properties for the black holes. And it's an interesting question which route it takes. The neutron stars are all about the same. And if you look at some of the statistics, it's really quite good. I mean, we dialed in this one central engine and we got a lot of things that are consistent with current observational constraints. Average supernova explosion energy for the ones that blew up, 0.7 beta, that's good. Neutron star baryonic mass, 156, gravitational mass, 1.40. Here's an interesting issue. Black hole mass average 9 if the helium core falls in, 13.6 if the hydrogen envelope also falls in. This is also going to be a very metallicity sensitive statement because the helium core is the helium core, but the hydrogen envelope is going to be bigger when the metallicity is smaller, when the mass loss is smaller. So going out to larger redshift, you might see at lower metallicity, you might see bigger black holes. Average nickel production, sort of what you see. Percent of stars that blew up, 2/3, 1/3 made black holes. Fraction greater than 20 solar masses, 9%. And pre-supernova constraints by Smart et al. And company say that most supernovae are below 20 solar masses, the ones that blow up. So this is a good template for state of the art today. It's not the end, but it allows us to make some statements about neutron star and black hole birth functions. And so I said the average mass for the neutron stars was 1.4, but it's actually a distribution. And the lighter ones come from the lower mass pre-supernova stars, and the heavier ones from the big ones, and you expect that. And the average is 1.4, and mostly comes from stars below 12 solar masses. But it pretty much, now the dashed line is the experimental data from Ozel and company. And we don't have any two solar mass neutron stars. We didn't have any of those in our sample. But pretty much we fit not only the centroid, but the distribution of neutron star masses, which gives us a little confidence that we might guess the black hole IMF. And that's what we get if only the helium core collapses, the light blue. If the whole star collapses, then the purple, and that's where the 9 and the 13 come from. Metallicity sensitive statement, though, especially for the ones up here. Now, again, the dashed lines show some approximation to current observational constraints, and 9 is a much better number than 13 currently. And so we think, somehow, that the stars shed their hydrogen envelopes before going into the black hole. But gravitational radiation can tell us something about that. Yeah, so. Well, it's a new constraint. It's going to tell us about it at things far away that we have not studied locally. It's not the only way we have of getting black hole masses. I mean, the dashed line is on the graph, and it didn't come from gravitational radiation. The dashed line came from measurements like you're talking about. Question.
Yeah. In addition to the distribution, can you also say something about speed?
Yes. Yes, and spin is a very major thing here, and I'll talk about it a little bit. But, you know, to jump ahead, the spins are of order percents, you know, for the things that are dying today around here. But the spins are going to get bigger for bigger masses because the angular momentum, you put in magnetic torques, run the evolution, you find that things rotate faster with higher masses, largely just because the life is shorter and the coupling with the hydrogen envelope lasts a shorter time. But also with less metallicity, you have less mass loss and you shed less angular momentum. So the Kerr parameter, I mean, I'm giving several slides ahead, but the Kerr parameter should be a function of mass and metallicity. And with thousands of events or 100, and if you can somehow back metallicity out of your data, good luck with that, you can say something very important. Okay. So some implications, and now I'll say what I just said, really, that the stars that these were non-rotating sets, but we've done rotating sets as well. And for the stars that we see in the Milky Way today, we expect Kerr parameters sort of like a few percent if the helium core collapses. A little bit bigger if the hydrogen envelope collapses, because there's more angular momentum per unit mass in the hydrogen envelope than in the helium core. So measuring the Kerr parameter is another, not the only, but another constraint on whether the hydrogen envelope goes in again, and how much hydrogen envelope there was. At lower metallicity, the hydrogen envelope has more angular momentum, it's got a bigger mass, it's had less mass loss, and so on. So more massive stars, stars with lower metallicity, will have larger rotation rates, larger Kerr parameters. And we might eventually be able to back something out of the data about that. A very rare set of these stars, maybe not in our galaxy because of mass loss and angular momentum loss, but some subset of stars in this mass range have to make gamma ray bursts, things below 75 solar masses. And those require a lot of angular momentum. They're either a millisecond magnetar or they're a collapsar. If it's a collapsar, it requires about, three or four times more angular momentum than the millisecond magnetar. To make a disk around a black hole takes more J than to rotate a neutron star 1,000 times a second. So first, there should be, well, if it's a magnetar, it's not a black hole, so we don't say much about the magnetar model. But if we do see black holes with large Kerr parameters, that will be supportive of the collapsar model. Now, it's a little complicated because the black hole that you make the disk around and make the jet and the gamma ray burst in the collapsar model, that's maybe three or four solar masses. It's the first event horizon that you form, the first disk that you form. And the A that you observe for the black hole is at the end, when everything has fallen in and you're all done. And those are different numbers because the angular momentum distribution can be complicated inside of the helium core. So it takes some modeling to back it out, but you're certainly going to want to see a few tenths of a percent of stars of supernovae make gamma ray bursts, so not a lot, but a few things with very large J and A. Now, there are mass gaps. I didn't emphasize this when I showed the plot a while ago. I could go back and show you the plot again. In the calculations we've done lately, there is very little fallback. Used to be, when we dialed in a certain kinetic energy at infinity, that Some of the helium core would go out and some would fall back in again. So we'd make things like 3-4 solar mass black holes. But now it seems with the new models, they either blow up robustly or they don't blow up at all. And there's a reason for this. Tom Weaver and I talked about this back in the 70s. We thought it was amusing. We call it the afterburner. When the shock starts going out, there's been a lot of photodisintegration, and you have neutrons and protons and alpha particles behind the shock. You can get an enormous amount of energy out of reassembling those neutrons and protons and alphas. So if the shock moves out, it gets a boost by having succeeded. And if it doesn't go out, it doesn't get the boost. This may not be all that's going on, but you do get a little extra kick that might make the explosions gated. Either they work very well or not at all. But because they work very well here, there's a gap between the top neutron star and the bottom black hole. Maybe 2 to 5 solar masses is empty of black holes. Now, that too could change with metallicity, because with lower metallicity, your stars have a more compact structure. They're more blue supergiants. And when the shock wave moves out, there's greater re-implosion, more fallback. So that gap, 2 to 5, which might be there, we think is there now, could go away at higher redshift at lower metallicity. Also, the upper bound, no things in a straightforward way. I'm sure theorists can tell me ways around this, but in the single star models that we ran, nothing above 15 solar masses, there were no black holes above 15 solar masses at solar metallicity. That's because at 35 solar masses, you lost the whole envelope and ended up with something around 14, 15 solar masses. And above that, so this is all very mass loss sensitive. And mass loss is a very big uncertainty in all of this. And so with less mass loss, you could raise this number. You could have less mass loss because you don't understand mass loss well, and we don't. Or you could have less mass loss because the metallicity goes down. So as you go to lower metallicity, this 15 should creep up. And of course, the Milky Way doesn't have uniform metallicity, and there may even be places where it was half solar, you know, that gave a different answer. But if you go out to 10th solar, you start making things much bigger. And it creeps on up, and as I'll come to in a minute, it gets to 52 and stops for reasons to be discussed. But this limit here will be metallicity and hence therefore maybe redshift dependent. It's interesting that so far we've got at least one system with an 8 and 14 solar mass black hole. That means those stars did not make neutron stars. They made black holes. And that's what's expected. You know, the average was around 9 or 13. But again, it might change with metallicity. And also, you have to worry, how are you making the magnetars then if these stars are making black holes and not neutron stars? Not a problem at this point, maybe never a problem, but it is interesting in that context. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
Low metallicity can make mostly massive black holes, 20 to 30 solar masses, or is there still this population of non-solar mass black holes?
You make all that you were making before, but you make more big ones. So I'm talking about the limit, not the centroid necessarily. But the average also creeps up.
So your statement would be 15 or 9, 14 is definitely low metallicity.
Yes. Yes, right. It has to be.
And the other event could be solar, could be low, you're not sure.
Yes. Has to be low, provided that our error in the mass loss rates is not bigger than 4. Okay. Which could be. Yes.
I'm curious about the mass gap. I mean, you said that the mass gap would go away, but could it be such a cross? We know that stars of 2 solar masses, could you make up a black hole of 1.5 solar masses? Or would they be abutting?
I don't know how I'd make a 1.5, I mean, that's less than the sure. Neutron star maximum mass.
So
maybe you are thinking of something, but I don't know how you would do that.
No, I'm just trying to say, if LIGO goes and measures 1.5 solar
masses, it'd be beautiful, because I'd be wonderfully surprised. But yeah, you guys go do that. But I'm saying you might, at metallicity 0.1, see a 3 or 4 solar mass black hole. And then I would not be terribly surprised. And I would even say, I said that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't hear you really very well, sorry.
Regarding the lack of fallback,
Oh, it could be all sorts of things. I mean, we've dialed in a very simple central engine, and as we all know, we can't model the explosion of supernovae with neutrino transport. Certainly not in 1D and not very well in 3D these days. So yes, that could be. Could be multidimensional effects will change this. But I'm just saying there is this tendency that is there in the simplest models. Okay? So thing two, how am I doing on time? Where's the timer? Are you the timer? Oh, there's the clock on the wall. Yeah, okay. So pair instability, we've spent all our time on this so far. Mostly going to talk about this now. I think by now it's entrenched, maybe even correct, that if you have helium cores bigger than 133, they collapse to black holes. And a little bit of rotation doesn't change that. We don't know what the mass on the main sequence corresponding to mass loss, common envelope, whatever, or even if such stars ever exist. And, you know, you can talk about the mass gap and so on, but just seeing one of these would be a tremendous accomplishment. And I'll bet a bottle of wine you won't see one in the next 5 years. Okay. to one bottle of wine to one person, not collectively to. Okay, but the regular pairs, those are well documented in the literature, from helium cores 64 to 133, and I like to talk about helium cores because then it's very clean cut. You might get to this helium core in a binary system with exchange or common envelope. However, you get to this helium core when it dies, the outcome is determined. So this column is uncertain. Depends on rotation, depends on binary evolution, but this is well known. And so from 64 to 103, interesting that things go in factors of two here, makes it easy to remember, right? 32, 64, well, 128, but, you know. So point one or three, this is big. This is as big as the whole mass range of ordinary supernovae. There's not a lot of stars. There's a lot of parameter space in that, just as big as this one. But of course, because of the IMF, there's a lot fewer stars here. And because of mass loss, there's probably none of them locally. Again, I said you have to turn down the mass loss rate about a factor of 4 or turn the metallicity down by about 10 to start producing these things in substantial abundances. And this, there's one pulse and the whole thing blows up, and here it pulses and sheds its envelope, first pulse, and then kicks off some more stuff and ends up with whatever it needs to end up with in order to be stable and stop pulsing. And that's a quasi-magic mass. It's between 30 and 52, so it's not particularly magic. But there is, if it's bigger than 52, it'll keep on pulsing and shed mass. Now, the evolution of this, I don't want to spend going to run out of time, I'm afraid. This is Kelvin-Helmholtz evolution of a helium core of 40 solar masses. And it takes 10,000 years to go from being unbound down to collapsing to a black hole if you leave out nuclear reactions. And this is the time scale that it takes along the way. So you can imagine you get to the end and you have a thermonuclear pulse, you burn some oxygen to silicon, and it reduces the binding energy from 4 times 10 to the 51 to, say, 2 times 10 to the 51. Then it'll ring a little bit, and it'll go back over here on this curve where the binding energy is equal to its current binding energy, and it'll go Kelvin-Helmholtz again, and it can keep going round and round this loop until it's shed all that it needs to shed in order to be stable. That's basically how it works. And that tells you that if you have a little blip here, you can go round in a short time. If you have a big blip, it could take thousands of years to go round the loop. And so the range of the pulsational pair instability is indeed hours to 10,000 years. It can span an enormous dynamic range of time scales and of energies. And the biggest energy, 4 times 10 to the 51 ergs, is essentially the binding energy of this core, because if you have a bigger energy, it's a pair instability supernova. Comes unbound in one pulse. So pictures, too many pictures, from 36 to 52 solar masses, helium core, short time scale, 3 hours, lots of little pulses, 10 to the 48 erg explosion. Moving on up, fewer pulses, more energetic pulses, longer time scale, on up to years, where the pulses start to be a few times 10 to the 50 ergs each, and there's only a half dozen of them. And then finally, there's just two, and then eventually there's just one, and that's a parent stability supernova. So on the long time scale, you get very energetic pulses, and this is a very interesting range, because in this range, the material can expand to 10 to the 15 centimeters before the next pulse happens, and then there's a collision that can make a very bright event. And that's a pulsational parent stability supernova of some kind. So the range of energies can go from 10 to the 47 or 8 up to typically 10 to the 51 ergs, and a maximum of 4 times 10 to the 51 ergs. For helium core masses, between 40 and 62. And you look at the light curves. This is about gravitational radiation, so I'm going to give short shift to the light curves, but you can get a broad range of transients from very faint, you know, 10 to the 41 ergs per second for a few days, up to ordinary type, these are all helium cores, so these are all type 1. You can get things as bright as a 1A for about 30, 40 days with structure, and then you can get things where there's a blip and you wait 15 years and there's another event. You can get a large variety of type 1 supernovae, and you put on the hydrogen envelope, you can get very long, 10 to the 40 ergs per second, 5-year faint supernovae. You can get a lot of ordinary type 2P supernovae. You can get 2P supernovae with structure, and then you can get recurrent supernovae. And this is, you know, quite a zoo, and what I'm trying to tell you and emphasize here is this has to happen. You know, there's no neutrino magic, no tooth fairy. This is on a desktop computer with nuclear reactions and regular physics equation of state. Any of you could run them, and a lot of you are, I suppose. They're robust, and they're in a mass range that ought to be populated if the mass loss rate goes down for whatever reason. So they happen. You can move on up. This is the brightest one I got that was purely thermonuclear, 10 to the 44 ergs per second for a few weeks and declining. To get to the real hypernova, to get to the real luminous supernova, you need to invoke a very large tooth fairy. You need to say that the core blows up and have a shock wave come out when the iron core dies. So far, everything I have said assumed that you made a black hole in the middle. And that's very reasonable, and I'm confident that if Thomas or Christian or, you know, some of the people who run core collapses look at this, and they will soon, I promise you, they'll find that this makes a black hole. Because the density gradient is very shallow. The iron core is 2.5 solar masses by itself. And the ram pressure of stuff falling down on that is going to be huge. The only way it might struggle out of that fate is with a lot of rotation. And fortunately, it has a lot. These things typically would make 2-millisecond neutron stars if they were allowed to do so. But all the rotational energy in that is only barely comparable to the binding energy of the mantle, 5 times 10 to the 51 ergs. So the star is extremely hard to blow up. So the common assumption is that these make black holes. And I think what you guys are telling us is, yes, they do. Because the first signal you got was 25 and 36 or something solar masses. That's just what these stars make. Is black holes of that mass. I'll come to that in a minute. But if you wanted to make a superluminous supernova out of this, it'd be nice to have some shells piled up around a central source and then have a blast of 10 to the 52 ergs. What the hell? And then you can make whatever you want, and there are people who will do that and have done it in the APJ. But the point is, gravitational radiation is going to constrain some of this imagination because it can't be a magnetar and a black hole at the same time. Okay, I wanted to be sure to show this slide. This topic has come up a couple of times already at the meeting. So there is a second mass gap, 2 to 5 I mentioned. This plot is for models with 10% solar metallicity. Some of them had different mass losses rates, and that's why you see different crosshatches at the same masses. And they show, as you go up from 40 to 120 solar masses, or helium cores of 70 solar masses had a 30 solar mass helium core, you get something like this. And if the helium core is what implodes, this is what you get. And if the residual envelope follows it in, this is what you get. And Salma, this is what Belshinsky and so on, why they got a big pile up at a nearly constant mass, is because they took these points, which is the whole star imploding. If you took the helium core alone imploding, then there would be a lot of things down here to 25. But the point is, this is a very mass loss dependent statement. Or if I turn the mass loss down or the metallicity down, these points can creep up. And this is always going to get blown away. All of this white here is white on the basis of pure nuclear physics, and I'm confident of it. But whatever happens from 70 to 50 depends on the mass loss rate, and you could, in principle, get things up to 75 solar masses. Unless you add rotation, and then the limit's 60. Okay. But there is a gap, and it goes up to 133, and it could be 52 or 60 or 75, and today I would guess 50-ish. All right? So summarize PPISN. A wide variety of transients are possible. They can last, single events can last up to 500 days. And beyond that, you start to see multiple events. It's hard to have one lasting more than 500 days without some central engine magic. Yes, you had a question? Okay. The maximum L is only 10 to the 44 ergs per second. You're not going to make a SAS in anything, 151L, this way. So you can make some very bright supernovae, but not the brighter of the superluminous supernovae unless you invoke magnetar formation. I mean, there's interesting numbers. This is all so much fun these days because what we're coming to, and I'll say things that, you know, you can believe, and if the experts were here, they'd say, oh, you don't know that, but I'm going to say them anyway. The maximum energy you can get out of neutrino-powered explosions is 3 times 10 to the 51 ergs. That comes from watching decades of people trying and from talking to the people who do it. 2 times 10 to the 51 ergs more likely, but 3 is sort of the upper bound. 3 times 10 to the 51, or 4, is also, interestingly, the ultimate thermonuclear limit that I get in the pulsational pair. So anything you see with more than that is rotationally powered, somehow. You know, that's the only thing that's left. If it's not thermonuclear, it's not neutrinos. So anytime you see an explosion with kinetic energy 10 to the 52 or 5 times 10 to the 51 ergs, you should think rotation, think magnetar. And then you might think, as I would think, gee, maybe it's not a sphere. You know, maybe it's got complications and looks different at different angles, and maybe the spectrum is being affected by the fact that it's not one-dimensional. But anyway, nice numbers to know. The light that you can get out of the pulsational pair is really not terribly large. Well, it's 100 times what you can get out of a regular supernova, but only 10 to the 51 ergs, because only a fraction of this can get dissipated in the collisions and radiated. They leave a population of black holes, 30 to 50 solar masses, the pulsational pairs do, and no black holes over 52, except maybe on that light end, as we discussed. Briefly, just a couple of slides about this event, because I got a paper from somebody and I didn't agree with it, so I wrote my own paper saying what I thought. And what I thought was that you could not make this event out of a single star. And maybe no one would disagree with that here, but I'll go ahead and say why. There was a model in the literature by Chris Fryer, who's not the somebody I was talking about, that had so much angular momentum, 10 to the 18 per gram, specific angular momentum, that when it collapsed, it looked like it would bifurcate and make two black holes kind of like the masses that we're seeing. And so if you had that much angular momentum, it might be a real possibility. But if you go back and do that model and put in magnetic torques and or mass loss, the thing changes completely, and you no longer have enough angular momentum to bifurcate. Now, you can go one step further and do what's probably the optimal single star case. You could have chemically homogeneous evolution with 150 solar mass star. And if you end up with 150 solar masses, you could indeed have core bifurcation and make this event out of a single star. But you have to have no mass loss at all and no magnetic torques at all. Sorry. This included magnetic torques. So just no mass loss. Maybe at zero metallicity, though God knows what Eta Carinae would look like if it had no metallicity, but if there's no mass loss, you could do this. But you put in regular mass loss, the star evaporates, and not only has no angular momentum, it doesn't even make a black hole of the necessary size, or 10% of that mass loss rate, it still doesn't work. So single star models for the event that was seen don't work. Part of the motivation for doing that was people, they thought they saw a gamma ray burst. I'll finish now. But they saw it 0.5 seconds after the gravitational wave signal. That's way too soon. If you made a gamma ray burst by a standard single star model, like Collapsar model, it takes of order 10 seconds for the jet to get out of the star, and it moves much slower than the speed of light while it's going through.
Remember, there was a gamma ray trigger 10 seconds after the event, and another one a minute after, so they just picked the wrong one.
Fair enough. So what I'm saying is kind of what you're saying. The place to look for the gamma ray burst, if you're going to look for one, is probably 10 seconds after, not coincident with the gamma ray burst. And so,
for any
GRB. Oh, neutron stars, sure. I'm talking about this sort of, yeah, absolutely. That's going to be primo, you know. Yeah. When we see that, we'll have more wine and more conferences. And that's a good place to stop. Thank you.
For the first event, can you get that through to those masses from a pulsational preinstability? I had the impression from your plots with the final remnant masses that close to the mass range where you get full preinstability supernova, you can get down to the masses to 30 or so from a pulsational preinstability.
If I'm interpreting your question correctly, the models that got the grid I showed was for 10% solar metallicity. And those, even for 140-150 solar masses, still had an intact helium core. They would have made full up parent-stability supernovae. So the threshold in this set of calculations for making a parent-stability supernova is 10-20% solar. Is that your question?
No, I actually mean you have a range for pulsational preinstability. I wonder if something that undergoes through that can go all the way down to the first black holes that were detected.
You mean to 26?
To 30, 36 or so.
Yes. Well, it starts at 30, yes. It's right on the edge. And there's a I'm hedging a bit because a little bit of controversy how much mass you subtract for the neutrinos. I don't think it's 5 or 10% like some people say. I think it's 1%. But you can drop the numbers by solar mass, maybe, by the neutrino losses. 70 solar masses was pulsing and ejected part of its hydrogen envelope. It had a 31 or 2 solar mass black hole. So it's right on the edge for the light one. For the heavier one, it's very clearly in the pulsational pair domain.
Okay, thanks. I just mean because this is a way to bring the spin down.
Pulses don't bring the spin down much. They just get rid of mass because there's no coupling. You know, as the shell moves out, it's on a hydrodynamic time. It doesn't slow down the core.
Well, but it's instead of the assumption of assuming direct collapse, so you will still be taking away the material with its angular momentum, although there's no coupling to the core.
Yes, you'd have to read off the angular momentum of the remnant and not of the whole helium core.
Yes,
that's right. And that would be a bit smaller.
So there was the one black hole where we had evidence that at least one of the black holes had a spin of 0.2 we were discussing.
Yeah, I thought that's the first time I heard that.
Okay.
So very interesting.
So yeah, I guess I'm wondering, does that tell us that these rotating core collapses, I mean, I don't know what that would translate in terms of the protoneutron star rotation rate, but is that already telling us that black hole formation is more likely than magnetars? What are your thoughts at that level of spin?
Yes. My thoughts were that, gee, that's an easy calculation to do. Why hadn't somebody done it? I don't think anyone has yet calculated a grid of models and said what the A parameter would be for the helium core and for the whole star for some standard set. I know you guys with MACE are going to rush out and try to do it before I can, but I'm going to do it. Yeah, well, you've got the magnetic torques in. That's all. Magnetic torques and mass loss change the metallicity and see what the J is at carbon ignition. So I don't know the answer. You know, it's 0.4, 0.2, 0.7. I don't know what the critical number is yet, but I just know that it's important. And this is a place where relatively simple modeling could make the answer more quantitative.
I guess it would also potentially depend on how that angular momentum is distributed throughout the star, if you had more.
Oh, critically important, because, like as I was saying with the gamma ray burst case, there's much more, you plot J versus M, it goes up as you go out. So the more mass is left behind, the greater the average angular momentum of the core. So, you know, if the hydrogen envelope goes in, it raises it. I hope that when we have some calculations and some more observations, we might be able to have a discriminant between whether hydrogen envelope goes in or not, in addition to all the other discriminants that we have. Yes?
Stan, you have been talking about stars with a hydrogen envelope and about the question whether this will fall into the black hole or not. We have also stars in the galaxy. For instance, four stars which have the spectral type WO. So these stars have no hydrogen envelope. They consist, they're very compact, mm-hmm. smaller than the sun, and consist of oxygen, carbon, and 30% helium only left.
Yeah.
And they are very rapidly rotating.
Yes.
So what happens with such a star? Everything
collapses. It depends on go ahead.
Yeah.
This was our favorite gamma ray burst thing. You know, it just depends on how fast it's rotating. If it's not rotating fast enough to make a disk, it all goes in the hole. But if the outer layers have a J sufficient to form a disk, that's the standard collapse R model. But probably most of the time, you know, having got to the point where it is, it's lost, especially in our galaxy, it's lost a lot of mass along the way. And so it's not rotating fast enough to make a disk. So most of the time, those are just going to go into the hole with nothing coming out.
Can you quantify what is fast?
The mass?
What is fast rotation?
Oh, J of a few times 10 to the 17. Okay. And now there are some papers, is it Ellie or Lars? I lose track between, but I had one and you had one about, you can have the star fall in, and then when the hydrogen envelope falls in, there might be enough stuff way out there to have enough angular momentum to make a disk. And then you can get day or month-long gamma ray bursts that way. It's a different kind of transience. Was it you?
Yeah
they cite your paper and they don't cite mine. but I did it too. Did I answer your question, though?
He'll convert the units.
Sorry?
He'll convert the units. He was fond of
Oh,
you want V-road to the surface.
You know, 300, 400 is gonna, but that's getting to the point where you might have chemically homogeneous evolution make the thing.
So let's assume LIGO has a choice between improving low frequency, seeing more massive black holes, or high frequency, more, you know, round neutron star masses. Which do you prefer? Do you have a strong preference?
About Sophie's choice, huh?
Yeah. Should we do high mass or low mass if we have a choice in terms of focusing
neutron
future
stars? You know, if you see them, you haven't seen one. I mean, I'd say black holes because you've actually seen them. But if you're going to see neutron stars, I think that's going to be the most exciting short-term thing. But eventually, you're going to do it all. But I don't know, Elliot or Lars, you got to. There are other theorists here that might have different prejudices. There's many of you.
I mean, practice, the instrument probably determines the path anyway, because high frequency, there's a clear path to turn up the laser power, squeezing. There's work we can do there. Low frequency requires A, understanding the detector to get even to design, and then B, significant work to get beyond the low frequency. So. Might have to live with.
Again,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's glue the output mostly.
We want you to do it all. But I would like the Kerr parameter, especially. Yes.
I was just going to repeat Selma's point. I don't think either X-ray binaries or LIGO binaries are going to tell you anything about whether hydrogen envelopes fall back, because they've all been transferred or lost in these binaries, closed binary systems.
You're saying everything that collapses to a black hole has lost its envelope?
In a close enough binary to merge in a Hubble time or be an X-ray binary.
Uh-huh. I see.
So it's an important question.
Yes, I hadn't understood it. Yes, it is. Yeah, I keep leaving out the Hubble time thing.
Any more questions?
Okay. So let it sink in a minute. So that makes it less likely that piece of parameter space. So you're saying this doesn't really exist for things that are going to make the black holes that can be seen.
It's stripped by the...
Okay, then use this curve.
That's the only curve you have.
Yes, that's the curve to use. And then 52 is the number.
And that...
But would they merge in a Hubble time? What fun? Well, it's time to go.
Okay, let's stop.